second hour, Darren, Donick, and Chase here on ESPN 102.5 The Game on this Tuesday morning. Hope everybody's having a good day to this point as I get choked up. Wow.
That
came out of nowhere. Excuse me for that. Wow. I don't know why I got choked up. All I said was we're coming into the second hour. But we always enjoy our conversations as I fumble and bumble around here on this Tuesday to catch up with Chris Lowe from ESPN, and he now joins us. Chris, how you doing?
I'm doing great, guys. It's good to be with you.
Yeah, good to be with you. I know it's been a while since we talked, and, man, it was a tough week in the conference to lose two legendary coaches like Pat Dye and Johnny Majors.
Yeah, and from an era when you go back to the 70s and the 80s, really on into the 90s, and you think about the lineup of coaches in the SEC, the just iconic coaches. You go all the way back to Coach Bryant, Pat Dye, Johnny Majors, I mean, on and on and on. The two guys that were, in their own way, larger than life. And really just when you think of SEC football and you think of coaches and guys leading programs in the SEC, I mean, you think of guys like Pat Dye and John Majors. I mean, both those guys took their programs to championships, conference championships, and really, you know, you talk to the folks on the plains, and Pat Dye arrived there at a time when they really desperately needed leadership. They needed somebody to come in and really sort of show them the way, strong, tough-minded leadership, and Coach Dye gave them that. And in John Major's case, you know, he comes back to his alma mater in 77 at a time where he was just coming off a national championship. And, you know, those of us, I shouldn't say us, but those that maybe are a little younger and don't remember, he came to Tennessee at a time when Tennessee needed him. You know, he had the talent at Pitt to win maybe another championship or two and rebuilt the Tennessee program to being a nationally elite program and won three SEC titles. And, you know, he's somebody who went to school at Tennessee. My dad went to school at Tennessee. And I didn't grow up in the state. My son, middle son's there now. It's hard for me to separate the Major's name and Tennessee, period. I don't care if you're talking about the University of Tennessee, the state of Tennessee, but what that name's meant to the entire state.
Well, we thought of you. We were thinking, you know, last week we had, unfortunately, when the sad news came up the very next day on the show, we had Jimmy Himes on from Knoxville WNML there, and he had some great stories for Johnny Majors. And you were another guy that we thought about because of your ties to the school and obviously the conference. I know that, you know, you've got your own Johnny Majors stories as well.
Oh, I mean, gosh, we'd be here for hours if I told them all. just the best of the best. But, you know, John was, you know, because I always called him Coach, because when I was in school, he was the coach of Tennessee. And even from that point on, I always called him Coach Majors. Really one of the few in the business that I do that, because most of these guys I've gotten to know when I was in the business. But he, when you start talking about telling John Majors stories, it starts with the way he could tell stories. He was a terrific coach. He was probably an even better player. But he was an unbelievable storyteller. He could talk and tell stories about everything, from the symphony to history to football. One of my favorite stories, when I first moved to Knoxville in 97, back to Knoxville, to go to work for the Tennessean, I never lived in Nashville. I always lived in Knoxville. Before, I didn't have a cell phone, so we had the old home phone recorder. And my wife did not grow up in Tennessee, you know, so I would call Coach Majors about something, and he would call me back. And one of the few things Coach Majors didn't do well is he didn't work his cell phone very well. He didn't know his way around trying to get in and out of cell phone messages. So we would have talked about something, and then maybe he was following up on a message I left him. And if he would call me back and leave these long, rambling messages on my home answering machine, and my wife, Julie, would say, Chris, you had a call from a Coach Majors. He left about a two-minute message, and I'd start laughing, and I'd get back, and invariably he'd be up in D.C. with his grandson, Brandon. He would give me his whole itinerary, you know, every museum they visited. And we went to the Smithsonian Institute, and after that we went here, and we went there, just like you were there with him, making all the rounds in D.C. And I loved that about him, because he would tell you stories, and he just would talk. One of the last times, not the last time, guys, that I ran into Coach Majors, I was in New Orleans for a playoff game or semifinal game, and I was touring the World War II Museum with some colleagues from ESPN. And I hear this voice behind me, Chris Lowe. And I turn around, it's Coach Majors by himself, taking in the World War II Museum. Because he's a huge history buff. And he proceeded to tell me everywhere I needed to go in the European chapter and the Pacific chapter, be sure you spend enough time here and there. And that's what was so awesome about him, is you could sit and talk to Coach Majors for an hour and a half, and football would never come up. You know, and how many football coaches, past and current, can you say that about?
Boy, you just took the words out of my mouth. I was literally getting ready to say that. How many of those people can we name? Not many, right?
He was something else, and he was a treasure. Charles Davis, you know, is great, and I went to school with Charles, and he said it. He said Coach Majors was a treasure in every way. And, you know, if you ever had a chance to go to one of the practices back when he would stand up in that tower, and the tower had those spiral steps that would come down to the practice field, he'd see something, and he had that megaphone. You could never understand what he was saying on that megaphone, that loudspeaker. And he'd see something he didn't like. Usually it was the DBs, because the DBs were his baby. He would tell you, I'm the best defensive backs coach in the history of the game. And he'd come sprinting down those spiral stairs, and he'd get to the bottom, he's out of breath, and he starts sprinting over to that position group. And I tell you what, the players, whoever screwed up, that he something he saw in practice he didn't like, the player or players who screw up were in trouble, but you know who was in bigger trouble? Their position coach. I mean, he would let them have it.
What made him such a successful coach? I mean, it's one thing to talk, you know, have all these other outside interests, and that's great, especially for the media, because that's just something that's not commonplace when you're talking to a football coach. But why did it work? Why did it translate to on the football field? Obviously, he played the game at a high level. Why was he successful?
Very passionate man about everything he did, everything. And connected and related well to people, was brutally, brutally honest. You know, players at that level, at the highest level, you know, they don't want to be told. You know, maybe when they're younger, you know, when you're recruiting them at 16 or 17, they don't want to be told what they want to hear. They want to be told how you can get better, how you can get to the next level. And Coach Majors was like that. I mean, he was hard on players and coaches. I think he's probably even harder on his coaches. I mean, you go back and look at all the assistants. I mean, his coaching tree, guys, is as good as any coaching tree in college football history. When you look at the people who coached under him, that went on to be head coaches, you know, from Gruden to Fulmer to Cutcliffe, Ron Zook. I mean, you can keep going on and on and on. Jimmy Johnson, if you talk about Iowa State, Pitt, and Tennessee, I mean, it's as good as any. But he just had a way of pushing you and challenging you. Keith DeLong, you know, who was an All-American there in the 80s, linebacker, great player, first-round pick of the Niners, said one of the last times he had lunch with Coach Majors, he said, Coach Majors looked at him. I love the story. And he said, Keith, I wasn't too hard on you, was I? And Keith looked at him and said, Coach, I thank God every day that you were as hard on me as you were, and you pushed me and you challenged me the way you did. Because, yes, it made me a better football player, but it made me an even better man, a better husband, a better father. And I think, to answer your question, that's all you really need to know about Coach Majors.
Chris Lowe is with us, and we are really excited to have his perspective on this today. I can remember talking to Chris after John Ward passed away. And, Chris, I got to say, you're an underrated mimic as well. I've heard a lot of people try to imitate John Ward and John Majors, but you've got some twists to it.
Yeah,
where
you've
captured this really, really well for radio purposes. I know you're a writer. You're first and foremost a writer, but I got to give you a lot of props there.
Well, I can't do either justice, Coach Majors or John Ward. Certainly not John Ward. His voice is iconic. You know, just some voices really none of us should try to do. You know, Larry Munson, John Ward, Caleb Ledford, those radio voices that were from the golden era of radio when I grew up. But, you know, I probably, and a lot of no, there's no real probably to it. I'm not doing any of them justice in trying to mimic them.
So, Chris, you talked about the family tree, and, you know, you have such a great grasp of the history here. I was a student at Vanderbilt. I can remember, I think I went to Vanderbilt's football game the day that Coach Majors had the issue and Coach Fulmer came in, and then the whole thing spiraled from there. So the details for me are sketchy on how it got so adversarial between, you know, two legends in Tennessee coaching history. So I've always kind of hoped, you know, from where I sit, just, you know, way far away, that those two would be able to mend the fence a little bit, and I guess it didn't happen that much. And so, you know, I go back to that time, and I'm thinking, you know, how did it get so adversarial to where they could never, you know, even years and decades later, come around a little bit? So what's your best answer to that?
Yeah, well, you know, you go back to that 92 season, and really Coach Majors, I think Vanderbilt was the last game he coached, but I think the announcement that he was out was a few weeks earlier, a week earlier, at I think Memphis, actually. And I'll never forget that press conference. You know, see him there with his glasses on reading a statement. You know, it's let me start by saying this. I mean, for most of my lifetime, the two faces of Tennessee football were John Majors and Philip Fulmer. Really for 35 years?
Yeah.
They were two head coaches of that program. And I think it's – I don't care what side of the fence you're on or how you look at it or what version of the story, because there's a lot of different versions of that story. I don't care where you are in that. It's a sad situation because you got two guys that have meant in their own way so much to that university and that football program. And you're right, there was no relationship toward the end, and there's, you know, there's blame to go around. And I know Coach Majors toward the end, you know, I knew better than to bring it up because I knew just how hurt, you know, it's a hurt that he never got over. You know, it's mm-hmm. bitterness he never got over. I think probably, and I'd spoken to Coach Fulmer about it, and I think probably he would have been willing, you know, toward the end to try, you know. But he also knew where that was going to lead, and it just, you know, it is what it is. I mean, it's sad. I think anybody that's connected to the University of Tennessee in any way still looks back on that situation with sadness. Because, again, they both meant and do still mean so much to that university. But long story short, you know, Coach Majors was pushed out. You know, he had the heart bypass surgery and didn't start the 1992 season as coach because he's recovering. Coach Fulmer was coaching, and they got off to a great start. They beat Florida, they beat Georgia. And essentially what happened was, you know, Coach Majors came back really before his superiors knew he was going to come back to coach, and that didn't sit well with a lot of people. And the team sort of went in the tank after that, and there was a movement among the higher-ups to push him out, you know, and it was handled poorly. And I don't care, again, whether you – how you look at it, the whole thing was handled poorly for a guy that was as iconic and legendary. And there were times that, you know, there were a lot of things that happened to Coach Fulmer, Coach Majors didn't handle well. You know, when things like that happen, there's never one person or one version that's the gospel. It's the truth sort of somewhere in the middle usually. And again, I think you could bring 50 people on your show right now and ask them about what happened, you're probably going to get a little bit different version. I'm blessed in this, as I had a great relationship with Coach Majors. I continue to have a great relationship with Coach Fulmer. And I know, again, have been an alumnus of the university, how much they both mean to the University of Tennessee.
Here's another historical part of this that we talked with Jimmy about, and I'd be curious to know your perspective on it. You know, Tennessee had these really powerful teams in the early 70s, some really exciting teams. And then, of course, they fell on the hard times, and Coach Majors wins the national championship at Pittsburgh and then gets the job at Tennessee. But it took them a while to build it back to where they had some success. And one of the things that we were kind of kicking around was, in this day and age, with how impatient, you know, passionate fan bases tend to be, you know, and also factoring in the dynamic that you're coming back to coach your alma mater, which is always tough as well, is would they have had the patience today that they had back then with Coach Majors? Because Jimmy, I think, argued that he may have been fired before he ever saw the bounce back of the program.
There's no way he would have made it, because you're exactly right. I've talked to people about that, because he comes in 77. Now, but listen, the program was in bad shape. You know, and the first thing that we probably need to preface before I answer that is, when Coach Fulmer took over the program, it was still a Taj Mahal. Okay, he had great talent. The program was in great shape. But when Coach Majors took it over, and that's not to diminish anything Coach Fulmer did, because he took that program to another level. and they won a national championship. I mean, Tennessee from 95 to 98, guys, was 45-5. How long do you think it'll be before we see Tennessee go 45-5 and win two SEC titles and a national title in a four-year stretch? I mean, think about that.
Not easy to
match. He took it to another level. But Coach Majors found a program that was struggling and took it and rebuilt it. But it took him a while. You're exactly right. And in today's era with social media, with the pressure, the money being generated, I don't know that he would have been given – in fact, I doubt very seriously he would have been given the time. In 88, they started out 0-6. 0-6. And he turned it around. And you can really make an argument that after they turned it around and won their last five, that was really the beginning of the resurgence of Tennessee football. You know, now they'd won the Sugar Bowl in 85, and that was a great year. I think still one of the most beloved teams in Tennessee football history. But to do what he did and keep that team together in 88, and then in 89 and 90, they won a share or the SEC title. I think we're over the next 3.5 seasons, we're 34-6-2. Again, in talking to some players that played then, Keith DeLong and some guys, that to me is the essence of who Coach Majors was and really sort of propelled Tennessee on to the success it had in the 90s. And then Fulmer took it from there to another level. But, no, I think Jimmy's right. I don't know that in this day and age he would have gotten the time, you know, because they were really pretty average from 77 to when they broke through in 85 and won the Sugar Bowl. They were very average there for, what's that, 7 years, 8 years?
We're talking to Chris Lowe from ESPN and reminiscing on Johnny Majors and the Tennessee program. And even though he and Coach Fulmer never made up, they never worked things out. I know after Coach Fulmer left and Lane Kiffin took over and, of course, Derek Dooley, Butch Jones, you saw Coach Majors around the program more. How important was that to at least have that back in his life, that he was able to not necessarily make up with Philip Fulmer, but be back at Tennessee in some capacity?
Well, listen, Coach Majors never fell in love with his alma mater, Tennessee. Okay, that was never Tennessee. He would always tell you there were just a few people that he couldn't get past, a few people. I mean, even after Philip took over as AD, I would run into Coach Majors there in the complex from time to time. He'd go back to see people. You know, he went over to Durham and spent some time with Cutcliffe. Cutcliffe invited him over, you know, and I think initially there was some, you know, that was an icy relationship too, but, you know, they were able to get past that. And I think it was a pretty emotional scene, Cutcliffe asking to speak to his team. But he came back. Coach Majors came back. Lane was great about bringing him back. You know, several of those coaches afterward. And there was always an open door for him to come back when Phillip took over as AD as well, and you would see him over there. He never lost his love or his passion for the University of Tennessee. I mean, his whole family was so ingrained, not only in that university, but in that state. There was just a few people that he felt like, rightfully or wrongfully so, that were part of, you know, the coup to push him out, and he just never could get past that.
I'll ask you the same question that I asked Jimmy when we had him on last week. I'm about to turn 33 years old, so I obviously don't remember some of the things that you've been talking about, and most of them were before my time. I know the history of the program, but a lot of what I witness was under Philip Fulmer. So if there's one thing you could tell somebody, you know, my age or my era about John Majors that they absolutely need to know, what would it be?
The pride that he carried with him from being a Tennessean. You know, again, just the, you know, his dad, Shirley, coaching at the University of the South, his brothers playing there, and just how proud he was to be from that state and to represent and wear the orange as a player, as a coach. We could sit here right now, and I've had this conversation with him over many lunches. There are very few people in college football who are as impactful at their college as both a player and coach as John Majors, and he was immensely proud of that.
Then Chris, last thing. What do you think what's happened with Mike Norvell? Let's get one college football in there on the way out. With what happened at Florida State with Mike Norvell, Dabo Swinney has been all over ESPN today. with what happened with his coach and just these players speaking out and just the times that we're in right now. How much do you think that is going to change the dynamic between the coach and the student-athlete relationship, or will it?
I think we'd already started to see that. You know, the players are more empowered than they've ever been. They understand that, they realize that they know their voices are going to be heard more than ever. And I think coaches now are seeing, and I think a lot of coaches already realize it, this, that they better be as good a listener and better hear their players better than they ever have before. And I'm talking about players from all backgrounds and all cultures, okay? And I think that's the thing that we've seen more than ever over the last couple of weeks. But I think we're already moving in that direction when we get back to the, you know, the name, image, likeness. And for so long, you know, players felt like they didn't have a voice. I think you're going to see that continue to change. And, you know, you hear coaches talking right now. I think the best thing coaches can do right now, all coaches, you mentioned a couple in particular, but all coaches, the best thing they can do is sit down and listen and talk to their players and see what they can do to help their players feel like, no matter who they are or where they're from, that they have a voice and they're truly a part of that university and the program.
Good stuff as always. You and the family continue to be safe, and we love our talks with you, and we'll talk to you down the road. Thanks for doing this.
All right, guys. Thanks for having me. Take care.
All right. That is Chris Lowe from ESPN. Does a fine job of covering college football for them, and he's been doing it for a long time. Does a really good work. We'll come back. More of Darren Donick and Chase on the other side. ESPN 102.5 The Game. Back here on this Tuesday morning, good stuff from Chris Lowe from ESPN.
You really like that song, don't you, Darren? We almost played like half the song. I mean, I like Elton John too, but
I do like the song.
Yeah, I had a little air guitar.
It wasn't because I was jamming out. I was actually running back up the stairs.
I thought you had it muted again.
I went to go grab a water, and I got caught up with the dogs. And
you got distracted in the hallway.
Well, no, this is if truth be told. Okay, so here's the story. So Maddox is in this phase of catching lightning bugs, right? We all did this as a kid, right? We all did it. At least I hope so. I look back, I'm kind of like shameful.
Put them in a jar, poke holes in the top of the jar.
Yeah, but I also, like, at times, you know, I look back and I'm like, I can't believe I'm going to admit this, but it's just the truth, stupid kid. You know, I'd take baseball bats and I would practice baseball by hitting lightning bugs with the bat, you know, and it's like looking back now, I was like, God, what an idiot. Why would you do that? I was a kid. But we also caught them, and we, like you said, poked holes in, you know, in the bottle and tried to keep them, and, you know, they always died. I mean, who's kidding who? Well, Maddox is in that phase. And sure enough, we had practice last night, and afterwards, him and some of the boys on the team, they're running around catching lightning bugs. Well, you know, these you take Gatorade bottles or, you know, Powerade, whatever, because these are hot days. And Maddox had his Gatorade bottle, and he thought he drank it all, but there was a little bit down the bottom. Well, he caught a bunch of them, and, you know, so we took them home. And I told him when we brought everything in, I was like, you know, make sure you leave the cap off. They got to breathe, man, just like you. They got to breathe. You can't, like, twist the cap on. They have to have – you got to either poke holes or, you know, give them air. So, sure enough – He took the cap off. He slid it off to the side so he had, you know, air coming in. But I went outside into the garage because there's a fridge out there I keep waters in. And the thing was sitting on the stairs, and I, like, pick it up. And, of course, it's just got nothing but dead lightning bugs. And I was like, man, I don't. And then there was, like, a little bit of Gatorade in there still. And I'm like, they're floating around. I was like, oh, man, this was a disaster. Like, this, these poor lightning bugs had no chance. And so I was telling, you know, Lauren, I was like, they had no chance. They had no chance. So I'm making my case for the lightning bugs. Like, these poor lightning bugs. And so I had to throw the Gatorade bottle out. And, you know, and Maddox is not here. He's at Taekwondo today. And so later today I'm going to have a talk with him. Like, man, you killed those lightning bugs. You killed your lightning bugs. They're dead. They're gone.
You didn't give them a chance. You didn't give
them
a chance.
They're dead, buried, gone.
They're dead, buried, and gone. You didn't give them a chance. So, well, I'll have to tackle that subject matter tonight. But that's what I was doing.
Didn't you do the old-fashioned thing of the jar? You have the jar.
Yes, yeah.
And you poke hole. Don't you take a screwdriver and, like, you know,
just
pop
jam
it?
Some hole. Yeah.
Pop
jam
a couple holes. Yeah.
Well, we even that's did the mason what? Jar, you know, and put them in there and leave them some air in there that away from the top. I mean, we had different, whether it was a plastic bottle or a mason jar, but we, you know, that's what you did. You went around and you captured lightning bugs. And, you know, it was funny on the way home. He's like, what, you know, what makes them light up? And I'm like, Maddox, man, I don't know, man. It's a great question. I don't know.
Stock radio kid. I don't.
Yeah,
I don't,
exactly.
Know
it's like, does dad have a lab coat on? No, I don't know. What? It's cool. You know, that's why they're called lightning bugs. I don't know. I don't know how, son, it's a great question, but I don't know. Do either one of you know why they light
up
or how they light
up? I'm a sports talk radio host. I have no idea.
Yeah. You know what? I watch a lot of the channels, the animal
channels.
I feel like my
brain hurts. I feel like it's in my brain somewhere. I've had it explained to me, you know, the substance that they have in their tail or whatever, but I can't do it justice. I can't do it.
Lightning bugs or fireflies produce a chemical reaction inside their bodies that allow them to light up. This type of light production is called, bioluminescence.
Uh-huh, sure.
When oxygen combines with calcium and a lot of big words, ATP, we'll call it that, and the chemical luciferin in the presence. Whatever. A lot of big words there. Apparently there's some chemical.
What
reaction.
A poop emoji show this segment's turned into.
Send that to Maddox.
Chase Googles it and just goes to a lot of big words.
Yes.
Well, that's why I didn't
attempt.
Know.
That's why I didn't attempt to answer it. Yeah.
Well, I fell on that sword for you, Willie. That's what teammates do. I'm here for you.
I appreciate you, Chase. I'll pick you up. It's one of those you got knocked to the court. Try to draw the charge. I'll come over and help you up.
What cracked me up is just how the 8-year-olds are explaining to me, you know, their unique strategy to catching lightning bugs. Like, there's some, like, they have discovered, see, now what you do is right after they light up, it's like, you know, it's 8-year-olds. And so I get a chuckle out of them. Like, they really were serious about teaching me their strategy on how you catch lightning bugs. And so it's good to be 8, man. I'm sure I was just like that at 8. At least I hope I was. That was fun. So anyway, I like Elton John. I would have loved to sit there and listen to it, but that's not the real reason that it played as long as it did. That's the reason. Because I was racing back upstairs because I was throwing the dead lightning bugs away.
Well, that's good. That you were taking care of business and that's okay. But look, Crocodile Rock is a good song. So I was sitting here singing and jamming. You know, I almost grabbed the guitar. I was going to try and play along with it. But then you came back.
I did see where, I don't know if you guys have seen this, I saw it on Sports Illustrated, that or SI.com, that Butch Spearden, who we had on the show last week, has said that the city is very interested in getting the NFL draft back. Now, of course, Las Vegas, it was interesting. We went to Las Vegas yesterday, had a really good conversation with Adam Hill yesterday and just kind of the landscape of the Vegas Strip and that market right now. And, you know, when it deals with the NHL, will they be a hub city? The casinos are back open. And remember, they lost out, unfortunately, on the NFL draft, a live NFL draft. So they got pushed back. Cleveland is going to get next year, and then Vegas will be the year after that, and then Kansas City. So those are the next 3 years. But after that, starting in 2024, I guess it's wide open, and Butch Spearden is starting to make it publicly known that Nashville is ready to tell the league, hey, we're ready to host again. So can you put us on the docket for 2024 or 2025? I know it was a huge hit here. I know the NFL would love to come back here, but do you guys think it'll be that quick?
I actually do. I just feel like all these leagues are realizing, you know, because I wonder when the NHL All-Star Game might circle back around. I you know, the NHL draft is another one that has come up. I just think these leagues realize – Nashville is a place that we need to be. I mean, I've even seen rumblings and heard rumblings that NASCAR's news last week has lit a fire under the folks trying to get the fairgrounds going.
Oh, they finally woke up, like the NCAA? Yeah, you just have to kind of clap your hands sometimes, like, wake up, come on, let's go. Come on.
Excuse
Nap
me.
Time. Nap yep. time's over.
Yeah, but it's just they're all going, yeah, Nashville's important, so every few years we need to have some sort of event. I mean, how many times, I would say in the next year or so, if baseball, you know, if people start talking to them again, they'll probably have the winter meetings here. I mean, they come here all the time with their winter meetings out at Opryland. I mean, you guys have done shows out there. I've been out there a couple of times.
We've made relationships
sure.
at baseball meetings.
Sure. So I it wouldn't shock me at all if the NFL is like, yeah, Nashville's a good place to be. Let's go ahead and head back there. So I wouldn't be surprised.
I'm just asking, not surprised. I mean, of course, but I'm just saying, do you think that they're just going to try to keep rewarding markets with the draft, or do you think there's kind of a cutoff point, you know, to where they say, okay, that's kind of our grouping? And, you know, they reward, or maybe, let's see, you reward Miami with Super Bowls all the time. You reward Arizona with Super Bowls all the time. You reward New Orleans with Super Bowls all the time. Maybe, you know, we exclude them because they get Super Bowls, and we go to other markets that
yeah.
can host the draft instead.
Well, they've kind of been doing that. Now, Vegas is going to get a Super Bowl.
Oh, there's no doubt about that.
There's no doubt that that's going to happen, but yeah, I kind of feel like that's the plan they've had. So since they left New York, they've gone to Chicago, Philly, here. There'll be Cleveland next year. What am I missing?
Well, didn't they do one of them twice?
Yeah.
They went to Dallas too, right? Went to Jerry's place.
Yeah, went to Dallas. So that's one that they've had the Super Bowl. But, yeah, Chicago, I think, had it twice. So they've done that, and then Cleveland – I mean, I don't – and you lived in Cleveland. You obviously have a lot of friends in Cleveland. I don't – that one doesn't make much sense to me of why they're going to Cleveland. Kansas City doesn't really make a lot of sense to me. But I think it's – I think you're on to something that it's, okay, there are NFL cities that we know we're not going to take the Super Bowl to, at least anytime soon. Cleveland, Kansas City, for obvious reasons, cold weather, here, same thing, / stadium. So let's send the draft. And that makes sense. That would be, and that's totally acceptable in my mind.
There's probably not going to be a Super Bowl in Seattle, so do they give Seattle a draft?
I could see it. I mean,
Seattle would do it upright.
Sure.
Yeah, so do I.
Sure.
That's all I'm saying is, of course Nashville, you know, but does the NFL go, yes, we love you. We definitely want to come back. But we also need to let some of these other cities get their one crack at it before we start going around and duplicating.
I think there's some of that, but then you also have to pull the books out. And I don't know the answer to this. This is me spitballing here. But you pull the books out and see what that did, you know, how many people you got and what that did for your product. Draft weekend in Nashville as opposed to other cities. I mean, we all feel like Vegas is going to be along the same lines as Nashville, but you know, you kind of have to look at it that way too. And if it turns out that Nashville is good for business, then I think they're going to find their way back to Nashville.
Willie, I will say this. You missed our interview with President and CEO of Dover International Speedway, Mike Titoyan. We had a really good talk with him when you were out of town. And do you know what I did at the end of the interview? I came clean. I came clean and I asked for forgiveness.
That we went on the track and drove?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Do you know what he said?
Why did you come clean? We got away with it. We didn't need to come clean. Do you feel better?
It's just a burden. Just a burden I've been carrying around. And I wanted to tell the owner of that track, well, the president and CEO of that track, that we had taken our vehicles out on their track. And you know what he said? We'll do it again.
All right.
He did. He doubled down. He's like, we'll do it again. We'll get this thing cranked up next year. We'll figure out another time. We'll go out on the track again. what I'm hoping is maybe he'll give us, like, different cars. Maybe we can all get in a car. Yeah. I don't know if they trust us, but, you know, maybe they give us a different type of cars.
If they watch,
if you want to wreck your own car on our track, that's okay. But you're not wrecking one of our cars.
You don't think so?
I would do the ride-along.
But I am going to try to see if I can come up with a better car. I mean, I don't remember exactly my car at the time. It wasn't. It didn't have much.
I do. It was the Volvo.
Turbo.
It was the Volvo. It was
the black Volvo?
Uh-huh. Yep.
Okay, yeah. It's just, you know, not much zip. Solid car. I'm a big Volvo. I like Volvos, but it did not have the giddy up.
No, you got dusted by the Sprinter.
For the situation. The Sprinter was beating me, no question.
The station vehicle just absolutely ran.
But
you
got to remember too. You got to picture this. This is a summer night, and it's dusk. Right, the sun's going down. They're not cranking up the lights for us.
No,
right. So, you know, the visibility is not great. And so, you know, we're not rubbing up against each other trying to win a race here or anything. We're just seeing we can, you know, get it going pretty well on the track. We're like, we're on a track. We're on a real track.
Darren,
I would like to see if
Durango,
I could get a
right?
little bit faster.
Yeah, I was in the Durango, the black Durango.
See, I'd be a little hesitant. Now, there's not much banking, so I guess you were fine, but that's where I'd worry being a little top heavy.
I got close to 100, and then I was like, I just don't trust going any faster.
Wow.
So I think
that's pretty good.
Yeah, I got close to 100, and then I just stopped.
So
I was like, I'm not going any faster.
I never realized that this was an unsanctioned event. I always thought it was just like, hey, you guys take a few laps. So,
well, it was.
I don't think it was sanctioned.
It definitely wasn't sanctioned. We were the last
ones sanctioned.
There.
No, nobody was there. Yeah.
I looked at Willie and I looked at our engineer and said, guys, we'll never get this opportunity again. We're the only three people here at the Nashville Super Speedway, literally. Like there's not a soul in sight, and all we have to do is pull out of here and leave. So there's nobody here.
Yeah, because we parked on
in the infield
in the media center there, and so everybody was gone. We were on the air until what, 8 o'clock?
Seven o'clock.
Yeah, 7 o'clock. 7 o'clock. You're right. So it's 7 o'clock, and everybody's gone, and we said, okay, let's just take a couple laps because you had to take your car, you know, near the track or I guess sort
right,
of
we're right
along
there
the
anyway.
Side of the track
yeah.
to get under the tunnel to get out, to go underneath the stands to get, you know, out to the regular road to leave. So we're like, we're going to take a couple laps. And so we followed our engineer, and we just took a couple laps.
We did.
We were all looking around too to see if any like lights went on and like some security person came coming over and said, "All right, bring it in, guys, bring it in."
Comes trucks with
I need some
sirens
license
on them.
Bring out the tow truck.
It was fun. It was fun. Michael Griffin will join us at the top of the hour. We will do that at high noon, but we'll come back and wrap up the second hour of Darren Donick and Chase. That's next.
We're back here on Darren Donick and Chase, ESPN Radio Nashville, 102.5 The Game. Willie Donick, Chase McCabe here with you. Darren McFarland will return here in just a moment. At noon, we'll talk to Michael Griffin, former Titan, always great perspective on things. Looking forward to that conversation. We had a great interview with Chris Lowe earlier this hour. Tremendous SEC historian, but more specifically Tennessee, with all of his days covering the team for the Tennessean before moving on to ESPN to cover the league. I really enjoyed talking to him. I will never forget, too, his perspective after the great John Ward passed away. And Chase, you've as we've kind of celebrated the life and looked back on the life of Coach Johnny Majors, who passed away last week, you know, it's been interesting for you, I think, to get the perspective. You're a little young to remember, you know, his heyday at Tennessee. You know, and I was just thinking this as he was telling the story. I remember exactly where I was when it all started really going down, the rift between Philip Fulmer and Johnny Majors. I think it would be a very compelling, I don't know if it's a 30 for 30, but it might be a SEC storied.
Yeah.
Although I don't know that they, you know, would look highly upon, you know, it's something that would be, I think, great television, but I don't know if the SEC Network or the University of Tennessee people would like to see that aired out. Because as you heard Chris Lowe, there's a lot of versions, but I think people would really be curious about all the things that were going on behind the scenes. But it's a classic case of, you know, what would you do? It's a very, very tough dilemma that they were in. And so for people that don't know,
was Chris the beat writer at the time when that when that all went down? I know David Clymer
was in school.
I
don't remember if Chris was on the beat by then. He might have been, but I was in school. So this was 1992, and I'm sure there's some Tennessee fans who were like, you know, you're going to tell the story, Willie. Let me tell it. You know, somebody right. really followed week in and week out. But I always think of it as kind of a, you know, what would you do if you're in their shoes, right? You have Johnny Majors, who has really come on and is on a hot streak, as you heard Chris describe. They went 0-6 to start 1988. And in fact, that was my first, that was actually my official visit to Vanderbilt, was while that was going on, and that was when the infamous incident where Duncan Stewart, the sports talk show host at the time, was up on the billboard until Tennessee won a game, and he ended up staying up there for several weeks. Right. So that was going on. I had that explained to me by Coach Mark Elliott, who's now the AD at Trevecca. I was like, oh, that's nice. That's interesting. And so I'm learning all about Nashville. So they win the last five games. They have a strong 1989, and now they're back to being a national power. So 1992, Johnny Majors has bypass surgery in late August, August 25th, just a few weeks before the regular season is supposed to start. They weren't expected to do great. You know, they didn't have a huge powerhouse team on paper, but Philip Fulmer, the rising offensive coordinator, who is, you know, now started looked upon as a potential head coach somewhere, he leads them to a 3-0 start, right? And upsets a couple of guys, a couple of teams that maybe they weren't supposed to beat, Georgia and Florida specifically. So you think about how big those are. So they're 3-0. And then Coach Majors, I don't know if he's feeling the pressure, feeling the all of the things going. And this is where I don't know all the details of what was happening there. A lot of people thought he sort of rushed back, even though he was, in his mind, he had been given the clean bill of health, and the team fell on some hard times. They got beat, and this is the day I remember. I was at Vanderbilt's game. They had just gotten waxed by Wake Forest, and I left. I couldn't even make it all the way through. I was so down because Jerry DiNardo had instilled some life in the Vanderbilt program, and you were thinking maybe they could pull it off, maybe they can get to 6-5, and Wake Forest, a game that they had to win, just thrashed them. So I'm all despondent. I get in the car and I'm listening to Tennessee, and they lose to Arkansas, and that's when it really started getting nasty, right? And then they lost a little bit later in the season to South Carolina, and fast forward, it gets to a point where I'm guessing the major force was they felt like that there was some contractual issues with Coach Majors, and Philip Fulmer was going to be a very attractive candidate to be hired somewhere else and may have taken a lot of the staff with him. So they chose to elevate Philip Fulmer to the job, and they forced Johnny Majors to resign. And that's about all I know about it. The who's, what's, and why's, as you heard Chris Lowe say, you could ask probably 50 people and get a lot of different versions of what was really going on and the true motivation of Doug Dickey, the athletic director, who had been the football coach, you know.
And that's your former play.
I do sit back and say, I do sit back there and I say, man, that's a tough spot to be in for sure. Because there are those that thought Johnny Majors got completely railroaded out of there, and others that thought that was probably the right decision, that they were, you know, they made the right choice, that Philip Fulmer was the rising star. And obviously, Coach Fulmer took it to a whole new level, right? They won a national championship, but they were a national power. So it to me, it's a little bit of an untold story. You know, I haven't really heard a lot of people go back to that time and really get into the details. Have you? I mean, you heard in your circles covering Tennessee, do people discuss that a lot?
I mean, it was always basically what you just said. I mean, my dad's told me that story of, you know, all the rumors that were out there and, like, how it's viewed. And, you know, he was one of those that viewed it as Fulmer stabbed him in the back and took the job. I mean, it just...
Well, that is definitely the one of the narratives. And that's certainly Johnny Major's narrative, that he was, you know, undercut, double-crossed, you know... He lost his job basically because he had heart surgery, right? And that Philip Fulmer behind the scenes was angling to take the job. And so, and there's other versions of the story too. But so that's the one that your dad goes with.
Yeah. And I mean, I've heard him tell that for years. But like I said, and you know, as I brought up with Jimmy and Chris, I mean, I was young. So I don't remember that. And everything that I've learned since then has just been stories that I have been told. So I would love to, I would watch a 30 for 30 or an SEC story. I would read the book. I think that would be good. I mean, I would love for the story to be told, but you know, one side is gone now. And you know, he's always been, professional about it, but he's always brought up that there were people, you know, he doesn't name names necessarily, but there were people, as Chris said. But I'd love to see or hear that story and get the truth, but I don't know if we ever will.
You know, when I Googled it, and of course, you know, you're not going to get, I don't know how it works, what stories pop up, but I don't see a ton written about it in retrospect. So in as far as the detail of what happened, I'm sure if I went to a library, I could find all kinds of blow-by-blows in the Tennessee and the Nashville Banner, all of that stuff. But, I just don't feel like it's been, hashed out a lot in the last several years, but that's one historically I'd love to know more about.
Yeah, me too. I know Adam wants to weigh
in. He was only 57 years old when that happened, Coach Majors.
Sure. I know quickly Willie Adam wants to weigh in on this.
Hey,
bring him on.
Yeah,
Adam,
so
what's going on?
I thought I missed my opportunity with the Johnny Major stuff, man. I'm glad Chris came on there and talked about him a little bit. I just wanted to say, man, I hope Tennessee fans view him on the same playing field as Pat Summitt, honestly. Like, he's the baddest man Tennessee football has ever put out. And you got to think about that. Like, imagine a player these days trying to cut it the way Johnny Majors did, playing both ways. Kicking there's some games where he never left the field. Like, players just swap out. He stays there. He plays he was so tough. And just a quick personal story, man. When I met my wife like 15 years ago, her granddaddy, I met him, and one of the first things he tells me was that he played football with Johnny Major. So I got to hear some pretty cool stories about that. But just what an awesome, awesome guy to represent the University of Tennessee. And I don't have any opinion on the coaching change. It's probably worked out the way it should have. It's kind of embarrassing if you think about it, how the coaching changes over the last, like, decade have happened for the Vols when you look at those legends. But, yeah, Johnny Majors, he's my all-time favorite.
Someday I'd love to get some people on the show that covered it at the time to give their best, you know, sort of even-handed, not trying to take one side or the other and just sort of – go through some of the dynamics that were happening there, because that's a tough way to go out. Because you, as Adam just talked about, he was a legendary player. Coach Fulmer was an excellent player as well, but Johnny Majors was, you know, Heisman Trophy worthy. In fact, there are many that thought he should have won the mm-hmm. Heisman Trophy his best year there, and so that's a tough way to go out. And you can see why he stayed bitter for as long as he did.
Yeah. No, I totally understand it, because he didn't leave on his terms, and with as much as he did for the university as a player and a coach, he deserved to leave on his terms.
Maybe we'll get into that in more detail someday. When we come back, we'll talk to Michael Griffin. We'll talk some Titans with him. A lot of great perspective from the former Tennessee Titans safety. Stay tuned. We're coming back with the noon hour here on 102.5 The Game.